Our second reading today comes from the book of Luke, chapter 6. Hear the word of God. But I say to you that listen, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. And if anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you, and if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies. Do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. The word of the Lord. August 8th, 1974. A scowling Richard Nixon sits behind a dark wood-stained table before a faded navy curtain with a stack of papers in his hand. I find it interesting that he doesn't use a teleprompter, which by the 1970s had already been in use for about 20 years by politicians. It's like he needs the papers as a buffer between himself and his audience. On either side of Nixon are flags and microphones. He looks boxed in. He stares at the country somberly. He doesn't smile much because, well, President Nixon wasn't really the smiling kind, was he? But he's especially solemn on this evening, because he's delivering his resignation speech following the Watergate scandal. So I'm bringing this breakpoint moment of our country's history up to you today because I'm especially interested in his apology, what you might call a non-apology. I deeply regret any injuries that may have been done in the course of events that led to this decision to resign, he says. So that's an apology, but it's also not an apology because it's so conditional. Was anyone hurt? Well, injuries may have been done. Done by whom, you ask? Nixon never actually acknowledges that he hurt anyone. He's distancing himself from the offense at the very moment that he's apologizing for it. Of course, it's not just politicians who are famously bad at apologies. It's professional golfers as well. Fuzzy Zoeller famously gave such a faux apology for his racist remarks about Tiger Woods during the final round of the 1997 Augusta National. After he said Tiger Woods, whom he called a little boy, owed his success in Augusta to the tournament serving the golfers fried chicken and collard greens. So again, in front of the cameras, this time CNN's Pro Golf Weekly, Fuzzy gave his own non-apology. He said, "You know, it's too bad something said in jest is turned into something it's not. But I didn't mean anything by it, and I'm sorry if it offended anybody. If Tiger Woods is offended by it, I'll apologize to him too." Again, he's sorry if it offended anybody. Not sorry for thinking that racist tropes are funny. Not sorry for demeaning this up-and-coming golfer, Tiger Woods, who went on that weekend to become the first black man to ever win the Masters. He was only sorry if his racism bothered anybody. I wonder, how often have you heard words like these in front of television cameras? Has anyone ever given you a conditional apology? And I wonder, have you ever felt compelled to forgive? Non-apology. Fake forgiveness. Compulsory reconciliation. A cursory glance at the Hebrew Bible lectionary text for today might be read as an example of cheap grace. In the final chapters of the book of Genesis, Joseph is the favorite son of his father, Jacob. He gives Joseph a coat of many colors or of many sleeves, depending on how you translate it, as a token of his affection for his son. But then Joseph is sold by his jealous brothers into slavery in Egypt, where he suffers this roller coaster of ups and downs. Until he finds favor with Pharaoh. He finds favor with Pharaoh because he has this gift of dream interpretation from God. You see, Pharaoh has this series of dreams, and Joseph correctly interprets these dreams as warnings by God of 7 years of coming famine in the land. So recognizing this gift, Pharaoh makes Joseph a high official in Egypt, where he helps that country prepare for the coming famine, storing up grain for the years of hunger. So by the time we get to our text for today, the tables have turned between Joseph and his brothers. It's the middle of the famine, and the brothers who sold Joseph into slavery come to him desperately in need of food. And Joseph appears unbelievably gracious to them. He sits before them high in his chair, where he commands millions, second only to Pharaoh. And he looks down on the brothers who years ago sold him into slavery. And he says to them, "It was not you who sent me into Egypt, but God. And God has made me Lord over all of Egypt." And there you have it. Cheap grace. The brothers don't even need to give a non-apology. Joseph kisses his brothers and weeps upon them. Have you ever been asked to forgive before you were ready? Before you thought the offender really deserved it? Before you felt that justice was done? Before you felt safe after the offender violated your trust? You know, churches love to talk about forgiveness. We can make forgiveness seem almost easy, obligatory. Have you ever felt guilty because you couldn't forgive? If we just skim the surface of our biblical text, we might make the mistake of holding forgiveness so high that it becomes an ideal. And because of that, we've asked victims and survivors and persecuted groups and people who have been wronged to forgive and to forget. We've asked them to do that without ever asking what reconciliation really means, without asking what forgiveness really costs or looks like. They swam in the sea, unencumbered, in freedom and in joy. Marjorie and Marcus, friends and fellow graduate students at Stanford, visit the Cape Coast Castle on the shores of Ghana in the last chapter of Yajasi's haunting novel, Homegoing. In the final scene of the book, the two run headlong into the ocean, meeting each other in the crash of the waves. Jesse narrates, Marcus closed his eyes and walked until the water met his calves. And then he held his breath and started to run underwater. Soon the waves crashed over his head and were all around him. Water moved into his nose and stung his eyes. When he finally lifted his head from the sea to cough and then to breathe, he looked out at the water before him, at the vast expanse of time and space. He could hear Marjorie laughing, and soon he was laughing too. When he finally reached her, she was moving just enough to keep her head above the water. So if you've been reading closely, at this moment, you know something that neither of these two characters could possibly know. You know that this joyful meeting at the sea, at the very end of this book, is actually a reconciliation at the site of a wrong that occurred between their two families, whose repercussions lasted for centuries. You see, every chapter of this book tells the story of a different generation of these two families. So in the first chapters of the book, they take place hundreds of years before Marcus and Marjorie were ever born. At the beginning of the book, Marcus's great-great-great-great-grandmother is captured by an African tribe affiliated with Marjorie's great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. And Marcus's descendant is sold to the English colonists. She dies a slave. And her daughter dies a slave. And on through the generations, until Marcus is finally born in present time. He's born to this African-American family that has picked themselves up out of slavery and oppression through hundreds of years. But that whole history is lost to Marcus. It's lost to time. And he couldn't know that his friend Marjorie, who he's swimming with, he couldn't know that she also is the descendant of that African tribe affiliated with those who captured and sold his family to the English. He couldn't know about how Marjorie's own descendants struggled and grappled for generations with their complicity with the English slave drivers. That history is also lost, just as countless family histories have vanished under the fog of slavery and imperialism. So Marcus and Marjorie swim in the sea. Their joy together in that moment was a moment of healing for a wound that neither of them could really ever know or name, for an injustice done between their families hundreds of years ago. Now, of course, Yajasi's novel, Homegoing, it's a novel, it's fiction. But it tells us a deep truth, that the wounds of history take centuries to heal, if they ever heal at all. That our lives are part of a larger tapestry of history, where the consequences of injustices can last for centuries. For example, 45 years after Richard Nixon's apology and resignation, our country is still stuck, perhaps now more than ever, in the toxic politics that he did not begin, but from which he certainly benefited and perpetuate it. 25 years after Tiger Woods won the Masters for the first time, white and black communities of our time are still haunted by the racist stereotypes and images that Fuzzy Zoeller repeated when he mocked Tiger Woods in front of the television cameras. In the face of such history, momentary apologies, they don't seem to count for much. They come and they go. The truth is, in the large scheme of things, our communities have tended to trade the real work of reconciliation for the momentary relief of cheap grace, for apologies that we don't really mean, for forgiveness that we haven't really earned. But when churches talk about forgiveness, you can hear those echoes, can't you? You can hear those echoes of Jesus' famous sermon in Luke, where he proclaims a radical reorientation to those who hurt us. Love your enemies, he says. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. You know, the verses, they go really quick, just one after another. And we've heard in them this command by God for those who have been wronged to forgive quickly and to forgive easily, even when the offense has not been made right. But the forgiveness that Jesus commands here is not meant as an excuse for abusers to get away with their abuse. The command is not meant to sweep histories of injustice under the rug like they didn't happen. It's not a call for reconciliation to happen only in name only, without actually changing anyone's life. That type of forgiveness can be toxic. It can be more harmful than graceful. Because throughout this gospel, you see Jesus standing with those who are hurting, with those who are outcast, with those who are marginalized. So Jesus can't be calling for cheap grace here. It's not that easy. Jesus' sermon in every verse, it's a call to a radical reorientation of ourselves to the real and the free grace of God. The love of enemies that it offers frees us from hate. It frees us from revenge and from grudges. But it's not meant just to excuse evil and wrong. It's not meant to re-victimize victims. Forgiveness and real reconciliation, individual and collective, when it is for harms that affect our lives and our communities, that takes time. In fact, it can take years or generations, and it takes work. Joseph struggles in Genesis. The lectionary excerpt is actually just giving us a slice of that story, but things are not nearly as easy as they seem. It's not just that the brothers suddenly appear before Joseph, desperate, hungry, and remorseful, and Joseph just forgives them on the spot. When we read the chapters before our text today, we find that Joseph actually struggles for years about this decision. The first time that the brothers come, he doesn't even reveal to them who he is. I mean, why would he? He sends them away before they even know who they're talking to. But things grow worse in the brothers' land. So they make that journey a second time to Egypt, where there's food. And this time, when Joseph gives them supplies and sends them on their way, he actually sets a trap for them. He plants this silver cup in the bag of the youngest so that Joseph can frame him for stealing. So when they discover the cup, Joseph actually tries to throw this younger brother into jail. But then another brother begs Joseph to be put in jail instead. I know, it's a complicated story. It takes pages and pages of Genesis to get through it all. But as you can see, our reading today only tells a really brief part of it. It's misleading to think that Joseph just forgives on the spot, as if that would be possible, as if that would be righteous. It's only when Joseph sees that his brothers have really changed, when one begs to be put in jail in the place of the youngest and the most vulnerable, that Joseph finally reveals to them who he is, that he forgives them, that he makes that statement about God being with him all along. I'm inclined to think that throughout these chapters, Joseph is struggling. That a part of him never wanted the brothers to know who he was. Or perhaps he never felt safe to reveal to them his true identity. Maybe he was tempted to revenge and actually wanted to just throw them into jail like they threw him into slavery years ago. However you read this story, it's messy, as stories and histories of reconciliation often are. But its conclusion nonetheless rings true. That reconciliation takes time and effort, and that God stands on the side of those who have been harmed. And from that place, God is calling us, as individuals, as a community, to do the same. The work of reconciliation, it's ongoing. It's not the place for non-apologies that feel good in the moment. It takes patience and it takes work. In fact, the fruits of our labor we may not see. If we're lucky, perhaps the generations that follow will. Let us therefore stand in solidarity with the victim, the survivor, the oppressed, because that is where we will find God. Amen.